Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. If you're new to our podcast, welcome. I encourage you to listen to some of our previous episodes. We've had some great leaders that have been interviewed over the last several years. And this week, we're going to revisit a conversation that we had some time ago with Carol Robin. Carol has been a professor at Stanford School of Business. She has taught leadership for the last 35 years, helping leaders grow. And she has written a book entitled Connect. She's got some great insights that I think will be helpful as you develop in your leadership skills. Looking forward to today's conversation with Carol. Could you give us just a little bit of your story and a little bit of your career history?
So it's long and circuitous, so I'll try to keep it short.
Sure.
So that it's interesting. So I've had six different careers, depending on how we count. My first career was in sales and marketing in industrial automation. I was the first woman hired into a non-clerical job at a very large industrial automation company. And I climbed up the proverbial ladder, and eventually I ran a $50 million region. And then 10 years later, I met my husband, who has been my husband for the last 36 years. And we were both at the same point in our careers. We were both junior executives on the rise in big companies. I was traveling a lot. In fact, the year I quit, I flew 100,000 miles.
Wow.
And we wanted to have a child, and we wanted to, most of our friends were both trying to do both the big career and the having children. And I'm just too compulsive and obsessive to do two things I care that much about at the same time.
Sure.
So I decided to, and we made a deal before we got married, that because we felt it was important for us, no judgment, but we thought it was important for us that one of us be around to be an at-home parent, and at least until our kids were maybe in high school. And that was the deal that we made. So instead of both of us trying to do both, I quit, and we had our first child 35 years ago. No, 34 years ago, because we got married 36 years ago. I was never good at math. That's why I taught OB.
Sure.
What happened was the deal we'd made was that I would stay home until our youngest child was well established in elementary school. And then we would swap roles, and then I would go back to work and support us, and he would stay home and take him the rest of the way. And it became our life plan, and we lived it. Two business people, you know, get together. He went to that well-known business school on the East Coast.
Okay.
I eventually taught at that well-known business school on the West Coast. And so we made this life plan. But what happened was, and my intent was always to go back to sales and marketing in some technical area. I had done really well. I'd made a lot of money. I figured, but the other thing we did, which might be interesting for your listeners, is that we froze our standard of living when I quit. And what that meant was we lived on only Andy's salary. And that meant that we also not only lived on his salary, but after a while, as he got promoted, made more money, we banked the differential. So that when I got back in, I wasn't going to have to make the kind of money he was making by the time he got out.
Sure.
And so that served us really well. And when the kids were little, not time for the swap yet, but little, I got really involved in community work and in the schools and in some nonprofits. I kind of call that my nonprofit era. And then I discovered in the process of that I was really intrigued with leadership development, and that maybe I didn't want to go back to sales and marketing in industrial automation. Kind of been there, done that, bought mm-hmm. that t-shirt. And so I thought, well, I'm really intrigued by this, but you know, what do I know? I was halfway through a master's in chemistry, never got an MBA, ironically. And I thought, I don't want to mess with people's lives and not know what I'm doing. So I decided while the kids were still little to go back to get a master's in organization development, fell in love with being back in school, got a PhD in human and organization systems. That sort of started a whole other branch of my life. And eventually we did make the swap and I ended up with some of my subsequent careers, some of which were in consulting and executive coaching. And eventually I landed on a lark teaching one section of this course called Interpersonal Dynamics, known as touchy-feely by all the students at Stanford. One of my dissertation committee members had said to me, you know, you'd be really great at it. It was there before me. A lot of people think I invented it because they don't know that actually, if anybody invented it, it was David, my co-author. It'd been around for quite a while.
Sure.
But I started teaching one quarter a year, and then life circumstances made me want to not be on the road so much in my consulting career, and the school wanted me full time. So I went full. I took a leave from my partnership. Because I thought maybe I'd want to go back to my consulting practice. And then after a few years, I was like, yeah, no, this is what I was put on the planet to do. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I ended up at Stanford for 17 years, teaching touchy-feely, becoming known as the queen of touchy-feely. And then I left Stanford in 2017 and started co-founded a nonprofit called Leaders in Tech, which essentially brings everything I taught at Stanford to CEO founders in tech.
Very cool.
So that's the big long story.
Yeah. And you've taken all the 17 years and put it in a book. So this is very valuable it's a great deal for the money. So I just got the copy last week and have read. I was honest with you as you know, I felt like I was, you know, showing up for the professor. And yes, I read most of the book. I didn't get to all of it. But as we talked about,
I do that to people.
That's right. I didn't want, you know, to get sent to the office. So, yeah. So anyway, you know, one of the things that I love about the book is that it's very practical. It's something that you can apply. There's exercises at the end of every chapter. And I know reading some of the endorsements, I always like to go to the back cover. You've got some great people that have endorsed this book. Reid Hoffman, who is the co-founder of LinkedIn, is one, and Ray Dalio and a number of others that have recommended it. But talk a little bit as far as kind of how hard that must have been to take 17 years and to put it in a book in the format. That's got to be a tough exercise.
Well, and if it was 17 years for me, it was 45 years for David.
Sure, right.
So and that's why it took us 4 years to write the book. Mm. In fact, I've often said writing a book was like being pregnant for 3.5 years and then in labor for 6 months, but that's a whole different story. What was hard about it was not just figuring out how to put all those years of teaching and learning. Mm-hmm. It was how to achieve near the results that we know the course achieves. So, you know, the second chapter in the book is called A World-Class Course, One Chapter at a Time. Mm-hmm. And what we were trying to do was deliver the same kind of value to the reader that our students get. And when we were approached by Penguin Random House to write the book. In fact, we'd been approached multiple times to write a book about this course, and we had said multiple times no, because the way you learn to be more interpersonally effective is by engaging with other people.
Sure.
How are you going to learn that? By reading a book. And so it wasn't until, our editor from Penguin Random House said to us, so let's see, how are you okay with having this life-changing course that thousands of students for decades from the world's premier business school say was worth the entire price of admission, only being available to those that are lucky and privileged enough to go to the Stanford Graduate School of Business. How are you okay with that? And that's when David and I looked at each other and said, I guess we're not okay with that. I guess we're going to have to figure something out. So here we are 4 years later. And that was the hardest part, in addition to, A, we didn't want to make it an academic book. So we wanted to find a way to convey the concepts in a way that were really accessible. That's why we chose these five stories of people to follow. And then we also knew that we were going to have to invite the reader to engage with the material. And that's why those deepen your learning sections at the end of each chapter are like, okay, now go do something with what you just learned that you just read, which is in fact the way the students learn all this.
And I held up the book. I should read the title because not everybody is going to watch this. They're going to listen to it, but it's entitled Connect. And the subtitles, Building Exceptional Relationships with Family, Friends, and Colleagues. So, you know, I think that whole idea that it's not just our work life, but it impacts all of our lives, our relationships and how we connect and be in the business that we are, as far as and trying to match people with companies and cultures. And, you know, it's not the hard skills, it's the soft skills that typically derail people.
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about, and I know that, 85% of the students at the graduate school go through this course?
Now they do. When I joined, they were teaching four sections of 36 students. Mm-hmm. By the time I left, we were teaching 12 sections of 36 students. It grew in popularity. And back to your point about a whole person, one of the reasons that I think the course, or not I think, one of the reasons the course is so legendary and successful is that what students report is, this didn't just make me a better manager or a better leader. This made me a better parent, a better husband, a better sister, a better human being. And then, of course, that becomes iterative. The better a human being I am at work, the better a human being I am at home, and vice versa.
Sure.
So it's a virtuous cycle.
So to talk about, and that you have one section, it talks about sharing.
Yeah.
And I think as a lot of the people that are listening to this are maybe new or up and coming leaders, and I think the nervousness of going into a new leadership position, you don't want to share what you don't know. You're nervous that somebody's going to find you out and that you don't know everything that that you're pretending to. But talk about that. And there was one area that had a diagram and it said the 15% rule.
Right.
A little bit about that and kind of thoughts behind that.
So first of all, you're absolutely right that there's a concept that we call appropriate authenticity. So if I'm running the marketing department, that's the third month in a row we've lost market share. I have no idea why, and I have no idea what to do about it. Inappropriate authenticity is for me to say, well, that's the third month in a row that we've lost market share. I have no idea why. I don't know what I'm doing. I probably shouldn't have this job. Even if that's true, it's not appropriate authenticity. But a version of that is, well, that's the third month in a row that we've lost market share. And boy, that's disappointing. I've got some ideas, but I'm sure I don't have all the answers. And that's why I need all of you more than ever. That's also authentic and it's appropriate. So people over-index on the not sharing out of fear, sometimes well-founded fear. But what happens as a result, and I can come back and share a story with you, is that they then get stuck in that mental model and that belief that they can't really share or show themselves. But let's come back to your question about to share or not to share, I think maybe the name of the chapter. So we all have imagine three concentric circles. The circle in the middle is your comfort zone. You don't think twice about what you say. The circle on the outside is your danger zone. In a million years, you'd never say that. The circle in the middle is what we call our learning zone, which is you don't exactly know what'll happen, but it's probably not going to be a disaster. And it's something you got to think about. So we used to say to our students, one way to think about experimenting with disclosure and sharing is to just think about stepping into your learning zone. But then students used to say, but the minute I'm outside my comfort zone, how do I know I'm not in my danger zone?
Sure.
So that's how we came up with, well, think 15% outside your comfort zone. And, you know, just a little bit. You'll know. You'll feel it as being just a little uncomfortable. But, you know, if it's only 15%, it's likely not to create the, it's not going to be the end of the world. If it's a disaster, it's a disaster you're likely to be able to fix pretty easily. And by the way, it's not that big a risk.
Sure.
And then what happens is if somebody steps 15% outside their comfort zone, then their comfort zone gets redrawn, especially if it all went well. And then they can step 15% outside their comfort zone again. So that's how we learn and grow. We don't learn and grow by staying in our comfort zone. But we also don't learn and grow by freaking ourselves out and the other person by going way outside into our comfort zone.
So having emotions at work, sometimes people say, check your emotions you know, before you go in the door. What are your thoughts around that?
I think it's such a disservice to us. And I think it's costly. So I'll tell you this quick anecdote that relates to what happened to me. So I was the first woman hired into a non-clerical job in 1975. In industrial automation. Trust me, if anybody heard the message, leave your feelings at the door, it was me. And I got very good at that, which is probably, I mean, it certainly didn't hurt me in getting to where I eventually got, running a $50 million business, 13 Western states. But what happened then was I was at a, an offsite with my team, and I got excited about something, and I got crickets, and I kept talking and I got crickets. And finally, you know, I said, well, come on, you guys, why aren't you excited about this? And one of them looked at me and said, oh my God, is that water in the corner of your eye? And then he said, are you going to cry? But then he said, are you human after all? Are you human after all? And that's when I burst out crying. And I said, you don't think I'm human? I don't think there's anything more important for us all to talk about than that. And I ripped up the agenda, and we spent the next 2 days talking about who we were. The bottom line to that was that I had overlearned. Yes, it had served me to be very cautious about expressing any emotion early on. And then I never questioned whether or not it was now costing me. And now it had turned into something that was hurting me and my ability to be effective with my team because they didn't see me as human anymore. So if I'd burst out crying the first 2 weeks that I was on the job, I would have never gotten to where I got.
Sure.
But so that's one thing. But the other thing is that even when you're first starting out, to constrain yourself and believe you can't name any feelings is also a disservice to you and your relationships. So there's feelings and there's feelings. That's why in the appendix of the book and one of the items in the syllabus of the course, there's a vocabulary of feelings with mild, moderate, and intense. And the reason we had to give students this is that we've been socialized so strongly not to express feelings, especially in business, that people don't even know how, but they're feeling it. So if I'm feeling upset, my not expressing it is not actually going to serve me because it's probably going to leak in some way. So I'm better off learning how to express it appropriately. And by the way, that builds relationship and builds connection, because if I'm willing to 15% outside my comfort zone express a feeling, then you might be willing outside 15% outside your comfort zone to express a feeling back. That's called reciprocal vulnerability. And that's how we build relationships.
So in today's world where most everybody is doing this a lot during the day, they're on Zoom calls, team meetings. expressing emotion, and I've heard people say this, it's really hard to get somebody's emotions through a screen. Any tips around that or anything that you think for somebody that's managing people during this time?
I think it's hard anyway, but I think you have to double down on it when we're doing all of this on Zoom. You can't rely as much on the body language and picking up, you know, what's going on. You can rely a little bit based on tone, but all the more reason why you have, like right now, I was a little bit embarrassed that my husband decided to go fill his water bottle with ice while I was on a podcast. Okay.
I wanted to see a real life. I thought you set that up and you were going to have an interaction and show it.
No, I had no idea he was going to do that. I was a little bit embarrassed. It's 15% outside my comfort zone to say I was a little bit embarrassed. And it's probably okay. And some readers some listeners might think, well, that's too much. I suspect most will say, well, God, that seems real.
Right.
Right. Now, for me to like fly off the handle and have a furious exchange with my husband while I was on this with you would have been inappropriate. Sure. But I also wasn't furious. Yeah. Okay. I was just mildly annoyed and he knew it. But by the way, he was mildly annoyed because I could have gone to my office and done my office. And then he could have been free to fill his water bottle without any big deal. So
that's great.
It's a real life example.
Yeah. No, I've apologized in the past for a dog barking in the background this year. And people are like, yeah, that makes it more real. So yeah, that's what we're all facing with these days. So talk a little bit, you know, I think one of the challenges that a lot of people in leadership have is around feedback. And you've got some great information in this book around feedback and challenges of using feedback effectively. Talk a little bit about that, just some of the things that you've learned and what you teach. Yeah.
Well, I want to situate feedback as a way to build deeper relationships for starters, because a lot of people think of feedback as performance improvement. And that's not necessarily the way I'm talking about feedback, especially with regard to feedback around behavior, right? There's feedback around whether the report was complete or not. I'm not talking about that kind of feedback. I'm talking about feedback on how you show up and how it impacts me. Most people don't know how to give feedback well of any kind. And they really don't know how to give feedback of that kind well, interpersonal feedback. And part of the reason that feedback on tasks and other stuff doesn't go as well is that underlying it is interpersonal issues that haven't been addressed or talked about. And so because I wasn't able to give you feedback on the fact that I was really annoyed that you had to come to me four times for the same information, then once you give me the report, you know, I talk about how the report could have been better, but you never found out that part of the reason that I'm not happy with the report is how we got there. So the premise of the feedback model in the course and in the book is that there are three realities in any exchange between two people. There's what I know is my intent and my motives and my desired outcomes. And then I also know what I say. That's reality number one. And reality number two is what I said. Reality number three is the impact of what I said on you, your reactions, your feelings. In any exchange between us, the only reality known to both of us initially is that second reality, what I said and did. And yet what happens is people don't understand that. And so as a feedback giver, if I've said something that annoyed you or was problematic, by the way, this also works for feedback on strengths that you want to leverage, but that tends to be easier. But what happens is instead of saying, gee, that's the third time you've interrupted me. And I'm finding it harder and harder to want to stay engaged in the conversation. So that's the behavior, my behavior, and the impact of my behavior on you. Instead, you say, you just want to dominate. You don't know whether I want to dominate or not. That's my reality. And so we talk about this metaphorical net between my behavior and my reality. And when you say you just want to dominate, and for those who've heard all your life make I statements, I feel that you just want to dominate is the same statement. And it doesn't have a single feeling in it. So what happens is when you do that, when you say something like that, you are over the net. You're playing in my backcourt. You show up, you know, let's say you show up to meetings. I show up to meetings late, repeatedly. And then you say, well, I feel that you don't care. You don't know whether I care or not. That's how, that's the, an attribution you've made or a motive you've assigned to me, which is why we had to give the students the vocabulary of feelings, because one way to stay on your side of the net is to say, when you did X, insert behavior, I felt Y, insert feeling. Not I felt that or I felt like, because it's grammatically impossible. You're almost guaranteed to be over the net when you say, I feel that, I felt that, or I feel that. But you can say, I feel worried about your level of commitment. Mm. That's on your side of the net.
Sure.
Just don't tell me what's going on for me. Mm-hmm. Because that's only going to make me more defensive. And the purpose of feedback is to move into a problem-solving conversation, not to change somebody. But that's why I say when done well, it builds relationship. If I'm doing something that's annoying you, am I better off knowing or not? But are you better off knowing how to tell me in a way that's more likely to move us into a productive conversation? Yes.
I'm going to have to listen to that section a couple times to let it sink in, because I think that's, we tend to react in situations versus thinking through. And I think that's a great parameters to have in our lives.
Let me give you a really quick example, because sometimes it sticks better with an example. Now we're going to go back many, many years. My husband comes home from, I'm now home with an infant and a two-year-old. He comes home after a long day's work. He plops down on the chair, picks up the newspaper. I'm starved for adult interaction. Mm. I come zipping around the corner. I say, oh my God, you're home. You won't believe what happened today. Blah, 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 blah. And what he does is he does not look up from the paper. He makes no eye contact and he grunts. Hmm. At which point I say, you're not listening. I'm not in his head. I don't know whether he's listening or not. But then it gets worse, because he still doesn't look up and he repeats, yeah, you went to that new nursery school, it hasn't opened yet, you're all worked up. Now I get furious and I say, how can you be so insensitive? How can you not care? By the way, all of that is over the net. I don't know whether he cares or not unless he says, I don't care. And calling him insensitive is one of the most unfair things on the planet, because he's one of the world's most sensitive people. So it wasn't until I could say, when I speak and you don't look up, you make no eye contact, and the only thing I get a grunt or a repetition of what I just said with no eye contact, I don't feel heard. I don't feel heard is on my side of the net. He can't say, yes, you do. And then I can say, and when I don't feel heard, I feel hurt and I feel distanced, and I don't want to feel that way. That's why I'm telling you this. And that now moves us into problem solving, where he puts down his paper and he says, if you want my undivided attention, you've got to give me some time to unwind. And I say, okay, how much time do you need? He says, half an hour. I say, half an hour? Are you kidding? I'd be counting the minutes for you to get home. How about 5 minutes? We settled on 15. But the point is, and it strengthened our relationship, because we also learned something about each other. I learned more about what he needed when he got home. He learned more about what was going on for me and my desperation for adult interaction. Everybody wins.
So talk about, and I know you're working with leaders of companies that executives, say somebody's in a position where, you know, everybody gets this idea of once you're a CEO, you don't have a boss. And then they find out real quick, you have a board. That you have to deal with.
I was about to say, except you've got a board.
Yeah. So talk about that as far as somebody that is, you know, they're maybe at a senior level, but they still have somebody they report to, and maybe they've gotten, the relationship is broken down. Any thoughts around that of how to repair that, or, you know, again, speaking up to, you know, to people that.
Yeah. So, and of course, I think there's a fair amount about this in the book. And what I'll say is, if you work for me and I'm doing something that's really hurting me as a boss or as a manager, or and you don't tell me, are you really doing me any favors? Mm-hmm. Who knows better whether or not you're being well managed than you?
Right. Yep.
So now there's a skill and a set of competencies in learning how to have these conversations. That's why we think the book is so important. Mm-hmm. And then there's also skill and competence in repairing them when they don't go well. There's no guarantee it's going to go well. We're going to move the probabilities that it's going to go better if you read and do some of the stuff we're recommending. And sometimes, as in the last chapter that talks about how David and I had a huge fight and I said I'd never talk to him again. And then we came back from that, and not only is our relationship even stronger, but we wrote a book together. And we can repair. Repair is possible, but only, again, if we've got the skills and the competencies to repair. And there's, so, you know, it's complicated, but I've got, you know, in my Leaders in Tech program, of course, you know, they're all CEO founders, and they all have all kinds of interesting challenges with their boards.
Sure.
And one of the things that they most appreciate about what they've learned is how to have these conversations in productive ways, instead of just bite down, swallow it, be even more pissed off, you know? I mean, that's one alternative. The book is also about choices and expanding your toolkit so that you've got a little more choice. One of the things that leaves us feeling, I think, most disempowered and trapped is when we don't think we have a choice. But we actually do. We have much more choice than we think we have. And we often, this comes back to feedback, we often don't give somebody feedback because we have already decided it's going to go poorly. And we have a mental model. So just like I had a mental model that I shouldn't show any feelings and it ended up hurting me, people have mental models that you shouldn't, you know, make any waves and give any feedback because it's going to hurt the relationship. And by the way, we don't get any better at doing it well by not doing it.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. Well, I did. I told you this, that I skipped to the last chapter of the book just to see what, because you mentioned it early on. So yeah. I'm sure there, you said a lot of people do that to find out this, this argument. So we don't need to go into it. It's another reason to pick up the book and you share some real life, you know, how you've applied it. And I think that's very helpful just because, you know, sometimes people won't share those, painful moments in life, but, no,
we kind of have to live what we teach.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have to ask this question. So outside of work, what do you do to recharge?
Well, boy, that's a really rough question right now because I have been, you know, I told you earlier, I'm an obsessive compulsive, and the book has just been, and trying to get it out in the world has been absolutely all consuming. Mm. However, I have a brand new 2-month-old grandson.
Oh. Congratulations.
And thank God for little Sam coming along, because at least I get to split my obsessive compulsive neuroses a little bit. And that's really good for my son. and it's also maybe a little better for my husband, since I can't completely obsess 24/7 about the book. I'm also a nut when it comes to physical health. I walk 3 to 4 miles a day, and I'm a big meditator. I meditate at least twice a day for half an hour.
Okay. Wow. So you've got another Leaders in Tech. Talk a little bit about that program. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah. So we co-founded it. We launched it in 2018. There were three of us who co-founded it originally. Sue Kim and I are still there. Joe Greenstein was our third co-founder. He was our first executive director. We amicably parted ways. I think in maybe 2019, pre-pandemic. And you know, that's a whole other story. You know, the two co-founders that, you know, our relationship is still solid. We still love each other. And we discovered that we just really had different visions for what we wanted the organization to be. And that happens.
Right. Sure.
And what a travesty if you can't, I mean, our biggest concern as we recognized that we were on different pages was that we would lose our relationship, because we're really, really, we have an exceptional relationship. We're dear friends, and we didn't want to lose that. In any event, Leaders in Tech, as I said, we started with a cohort of 24 leaders at a time, CEO founders, that go through a year-long program that starts with a four-day intensive and then meets once a month for half a day. And it basically is, you know, Carol Robin lessons from Stanford, both touchy-feely and high-performance leadership and some other courses that I used to teach. When we first started, I said, well, how's anybody even going to know we exist? And in fact, it was Joe and Sue who approached me, because I was still at Stanford. And I was like, no, I'm too old to start a business. And you know, besides, I love my students. And Joe had actually approached me multiple times over multiple years, and I kept saying no. But then in the spring of 2017, the administration and I at Stanford had a bit of a parting of the ways, and I decided maybe it was time to leave. And so then Joe was like, well, now you don't have that Stanford excuse. So anyway, in January of 2018, we sent out a couple of dozen emails to some of the venture capitalists that are in our network and said, hey, we're starting this program. If you know a CEO or a founder that you think would be good for it, nominate them. We got 300 nominations in 2 weeks.
Wow.
We got 180 applications of those. And then of the people who didn't apply, they were like, I can't apply for this round, but can I apply again? Bottom line, we've now had four cohorts of 24 and had over 1,200 applicants.
Wow.
So, right. And the application is no small thing. You know, you got to write it up. You got to be interviewed. Anyway, so who knew we were onto something? We're a nonprofit. And then what happened was those CEO founders said, oh my God, this is so valuable. What do I do for my team? And so then we launched these four-day intensives, which is kind of a taste of what they get over the whole year for anybody who's in a C-suite or an executive in a big company. Or all of our fellows have to have at least raised an A round. So also for seed founders and people who aren't quite big enough or too big, because they also have to be pre-IPO.
Okay.
Because our mission is, let's try to create a different kind of valley by arming the future leaders of the big companies from the start with a different set of both skills and maybe a desire to build different kinds of cultures.
That's great. So Carol, how would they learn more about what you're working on? And is there a site
if you want to know more about Leaders in Tech, go to leadersintech.org.
Got it.
Because if you go to just Leaders in Tech, you'll get all kinds of weird stuff.
Okay.
If you want to know more about the book and me, go to connectandrelate.com.
Got it. Connectandrelate.com. Got it.
Yeah. If you only go to connect, you'll get a million things. None of them are the book.
Sure.
Unfortunately, that was already taken. Connect.com. So, yeah. And I think if you just Google Carol Robin Connect book, you'll also get a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what parting advice would you give a new and up-and-coming leader?
Well, I'm a teacher, so it's not going to surprise you to hear me say that I think what differentiates the best leaders from the ones who are not as good is a learning mindset. Is a belief that you don't have all the answers. In fact, in my high performance leadership class, I used to say a leader's job is not to provide the answer. A leader's job is to make sure the best answer in the system can be found. So
that's good.
Falling into the trap of thinking that you know it or that you've already got that, losing curiosity. By the way, the more you don't understand something, the more you don't understand why someone did something, the more you need to engage your curiosity instead of judge them and decide that, you know, they're a jerk.
Sure. Well, Carol, this has been so much fun to get to know you and hear about your work, and definitely encourage everybody to pick up your book. It's a great read. And if you do all the exercises, I'm sure there is a guarantee that something will happen. There'll be some change in your life. And definitely appreciate all the work you've done.
You know, go to Amazon and read all the reviews on how it's impacted a bunch of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.